country. The Jews, everything, all the Jews. And so I went back because it was a recent interview with Michael Hudson. What are you drinking?
Topo Chico.
Nice. That's our
makes
drink
a lot of rack.
That's our drink of choice here in Texas. So Michael Hudson, we played him before. He's a professor of economics. He's an old dude. He's in his late 70s. I put a fair amount of work into this because he stutters worse than Biden, and it's really bad. And you know, I was able to shore up these clips by 40% in most cases. But I thought it was important because he was back in the 70s. He was there when the American foreign policy was designed. And I'm talking about people like Brzezinski, Herman Kahn, and, you know, all the way up through Wolfowitz and all of these guys.
The classics.
And I believe he is telling the truth. And I think this is where we are at when you look at Israel and Ukraine and many other wars in the recent past. And I talked a little bit about this on the last show, but I want to make this presentation. And it comes actually after this piece of information, which I didn't know, as the globalist Christine Amanpour was interviewing the foreign minister of Palestine. And I didn't know this, but it was a ceasefire had been agreed to, and then they killed the guy. They killed the guy, maybe it was Lebanon. They killed the guy in the bunker. Did you know that a ceasefire was agreed to?
Oh,
here we go.
I spoke with Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bouhabib, who's in Washington to meet with American officials, and he joined us for his first interview since the latest escalations. Foreign Minister, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Things have reached a major crisis in your country since we last spoke. And I want to ask you, you are in the United States right now. You know that several of the administration officials agree with Israel's, you know, ground incursion into your country. What do you make of that as you're in Washington trying to get support for a ceasefire?
Well, they also agreed on the, you know, the Biden Macron statement that calls for a ceasefire, and that calls also the implementation for 21 days ceasefire, and then Mr. Hochstein would go to Lebanon and negotiate a ceasefire. Okay? And they told us that Mr. Netanyahu agreed on this. Mm-hmm. And so we also got the agreement of Hezbollah on that. And you know what happened since then. That was the day we saw you in New York.
I know, and you were talking about going into the Security Council for this ceasefire, and barely 24 hours later, the head of Hezbollah was assassinated. Are you saying Hassan Nasrallah had agreed to a ceasefire just moments before he was assassinated?
He agreed, yes.
Didn't get a lot of play. Did you? I didn't hear much about that.
This is all news. This should be, as CBS with Nora O'Donnell, they just play a bunch of stuff right at the beginning of the show about Trump. They don't talk about the Raytheon. They don't talk about the B-2 bombers. And they don't talk about this.
So, and by the way, the people who think the Jews are killing everybody, you're not entirely wrong, but I just want you to understand the strategy and how that was built up in the United States, which is something that is not working too well, I would say, as an aside, and needs to be dismantled. So let's go back.
One phone call.
That's right. It may just be one phone call. Here's Michael Hudson. He's talking about this strategy that was devised actually back in the 60s.
Well, the United States doesn't want a ceasefire because it wants to take over the entire Near East, and it wants to use Israel as the cat's paw. Everything that's happened today was planned out just 50 years ago. Back in 1973 and 1974, I sat in on meetings with the Arad, who became Netanyahu, who's chief military advisor after heading Mossad. And the whole strategy was worked out essentially by the Defense Department, by neoliberals, and almost in a series of stages that I'll explain. Scoop Jackson is the main name to remember. Scoop Jackson was the ultra-right-wing neocon who sponsored them all. He was the head of the Democratic National Committee in 1960 and then worked with military advisors. I was with Herman Kahn, the model for Dr. Strangelove at the Hudson Institute during these years, and I sat in on meetings, and I'll describe them, but I want to describe how the whole strategy that led to the United States today not wanting peace, wanting to take over the whole Near East, took shape gradually.
All right, so did you know about this Scoop character? You ever heard of him?
Scoop Jackson?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was he a warmonger? Sounds like it.
Well, he was at the time, that was my era of being a Democrat. He was a great guy.
Wow. Okay. So this is what I discussed on the last episode of No Agenda, is that the Democrats actually realized that you couldn't get elected if you said, oh, man, we're going to have a draft and we're going to send all you boys off to war. That was no longer going to work.
The starting point for all the U.S. strategy here was that democracies no longer can field a domestic army with a military draft. America is not in a position able to really field enough of an army to invade a country. And without invading a country, you can't really take it over. You can bomb it, but that just is going to incite resistance. But you can't take it over. The Vietnam War showed that. Any attempt at a draft would be met by so much anti-draft resistance, taking the form of an anti-war statement, that no country that whose leaders have to be elected can ever take that role again. The anti-war students showed that Lyndon Johnson in 1968 had to withdraw from running for election because everywhere he'd go, there would be demonstrations against him to stop the war. No such demonstrations are occurring today, needless to say.
Although that's what we did expect at the convention in Chicago, but of course it didn't really happen that way because people aren't quite as animated as they were back in the Lyndon Johnson days. So instead, the strategy was devised as follows.
So this was recognized 50 years ago, and it seemed at that time that the U.S.-backed wars were going to have to be scaled down. But that hasn't happened. And the reason is the United States had a fallback position. It was going to rely on foreign troops to do the fighting as proxies instead of itself. That was a solution to get a force. Well, the first example was to create the Wahhabi jihad fighters in Afghanistan as al-Qaeda. Jimmy Carter mobilized them against the secular Afghan interests. And Carter justified this by saying, well, yes, they're Muslims, but after all, we all believe in God. So the answer to the secular state of Afghan was Wahhabi fanaticism and jihads. And the United States realized that in order to have an army that's willing to fight to the last member of its country, the last Afghan, the last Israeli, the last Ukrainian, you really need a country whose spirit is one of hatred towards the other, a spirit very different from the American and European spirit. Well, Brzezinski was the grand planner who did all that. The Sunni jihad fighters became America's foreign legion in the Middle East. And that includes Iraq, Syria, and Iran, and also Muslim states going up to Russia's border.
So, yes, that's exactly what's going on here. You've got to get countries who hate the other people that you want to get rid of, and they will do the bidding for you. I think we've been very successful at that. Look at literally Ukraine fighting to the last man.
We're going to kill every Ukrainian if we have to.
And we'll kill every Israeli IDF soldier if we have to. If you're asking, Why? Well, it's an age-old issue. It's always about the oil.
The aim of the United States was oil was going to was the center of this policy. That meant the United States had to secure the Near East, and there were two proxy armies for it. And these two armies have fought together as allies down to today. On the one hand, the Al-Qaeda jihads. On the other hand, their managers, the Israelis, hand in hand. And they've done the fighting so that the United States doesn't have to do it. The foreign policy has backed Israel and Ukraine, providing them with arms, bribing their leaders enormous sums of money, and electronic satellite guidance for everything they're doing. But the United States has been able to avoid all the opprobrium. President Biden keeps telling Netanyahu, well, we've just given you a brand new bunker buster bombs and huge bombs. Please drop them on your enemies, but do it gently.
So, yes.
Well, it should mention that Biden has also gone on and on to say he brags about the fact that the Ukraine war, we haven't lost. We don't have one soldier. We have no boots on the ground. Nobody's dying there from us.
Yeah, right.
And he goes on and on about it.
Yeah, because, well, there are U.S. military there, but that's neither here nor there.
They're not supposed to be, still, that technically.
Now we get to the meat of the issue, which is the Zionists and the Zionists in America. And he lays it out very clearly here. Israel is our foreign legion, and it's the Zionists. Well, how are we gonna get these? How are we gonna really have? We need to put these crazy people in the State Department.
When all of this strategy was being put together, Herman Kahn's great achievement was to convince the U.S. empire builders that the key to achieving their control of the Middle East was to rely on Israel as its foreign legion. And that arm's length arrangement enabled the United States to play the role, as I said, of the good cop, designating Israel to play its role. And Israel has organized and supplied al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, while the United States pretends to denounce them. And it's all part of a plan that's been backed by the military, the State Department, and the National Security Operation. And that's why the State Department has turned over management of U.S. diplomacy to Zionists, seemingly distinguishing Israeli behavior from U.S. empire building. But in a nutshell, the Israelis have joined al-Qaeda and ISIS as troops, as America's foreign legion.
Now you start to understand how ISIS all of a sudden bombed in Russia. Yeah, so those of you saying Mossad, CIA, yes, but it's really been a plan, and it's the United States controlling, not the other way around. And so back to Scoop, real name Henry Jackson, he was quite the architect of this whole system, particularly on the U.S. side.
The U.S. Policy, as I said, was based on the U.S. actually taking over all of these countries, again, using Israel as the battering ram.
West Clark 7.
The Army called America's landed aircraft carrier there. Well, all this began to take place in the 1960s with Henry Jackson. Initially, Israel didn't really play a role in the U.S. plan. Jackson simply hated communism. He hated the Russians, and he had got a lot of support within the Democratic Party. He was a senator from Washington State. That was the center of the military-industrial complex. He was nicknamed the senator from Boeing. Jackson was fighting all the arms control, said, we've got to have war. And he proceeded to stuff the State Department and other U.S. agencies with neocons who planned from the beginning for a permanent worldwide war, and this takeover of government policy was led by Jackson's former Senate aides. These Senate aides were Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Douglas Fife, and others who were catapulted into the commanding heights of the State Department and, more recently, the National Security Council. The Jackson-Vanik Amendment to the U.S. Trade Act of 1974 became the model for subsequent sanctions against the Soviet Union, claiming that the claim was it limited Jewish immigration and other human rights. So right then, the State Department realized here is a group of people who we can use as the theoreticians and the executors of the U.S. policy that we want. They both want to take over all of the Arab countries. I don't think there were any non-Jewish Americans that had that visceral hatred of Islam that the Zionists had, or also the visceral hatred of Russia, specifically for its anti-Semitism of past centuries, most of which was in Ukraine, by the way.
So now the entire State Department comes into view. We understand the thinking and the milieu that Nuland and Blinken and all these jamokes have been in. They have been educated for this policy that is U.S. policy, our policy.
And let's make it clear, antiquated.
Yes.
This began during the Stalin period, where Khrushchev, I think, was the guy running it, when it was the Soviet Union, which is long gone, and the structure of the world has changed immensely, but we're keeping with this archaic policy, which is ludicrous at this point.
And this is the last clip, because the system is no longer working, it's not happening, it's failing. And this is his wrap-up.
From the very beginning, they were promoted, supported with huge amounts of money, all of the bombs they needed, all the armaments they needed, all the funding they needed. And Israel is a country whose economy needs foreign exchange in order to keep its currency solvent. All of that was given to them precisely to do exactly what they're doing today. So when Biden pretends to say, can't there be two-state solution? No, there can't be a two-state solution, because Netanyahu has said, we hate the Gazians. We hate the Palestinians. We hate the Arabs. There cannot be a two-state solution. This could not have been said explicitly 50 years ago. That would have been shocking. But it was being said by the neocons who were brought in from the beginning to do exactly what they're doing today, to act as America's proxy, to conquer the oil-producing countries and make it part of Greater Israel as much of a satellite of the United States that England or Germany or Japan have become. That's become a precondition for their own solvency. It is insolvent. There's no solution to a black hole that Israel's painted itself into. And yet there's no willingness to have a single state, because Biden and the entire National Security Council, Congress, and the military, and especially the military industrial complex, says there cannot be any common living between Palestinians and Israelis any more than there can be in Ukraine, Ukrainians and speakers and Russian speakers in the same country. It's exactly the same. It's following exactly the same policy. And all of this was planned and sponsored by the United States and funded with enormous amounts of money.
And I would say Taiwan is on deck for this idiotic policy. So this has been United States policy. We are the bad guys in this. And yes, of course, the Zionists in Congress who get funded through AIPAC, which is directly funded by the corrupt companies, allegedly, who we just heard, Raytheon, they're the ones who the Israeli Education Fund who give the money to AIPAC, which flows through to the senators and the congresspeople who are all in on the military-industrial complex.
Except Thomas Massie.
I was going to say, see Thomas Massie, whose wife dies very suddenly, unexpectedly, yeah, after he explains how this works. So the Jews and the Mossad, I really don't think that they're controlling America. But this policy is outdated. It's not working. And it appears to me, specifically when we have our boots on the ground dude named Bahamut, that everybody in the region knows this is coming to an end. Trump's coming in. He's going to change this policy and he's going to fix it. And I really believe he's going to do that with the Abraham Accords 2.0 and will bring peace. We'll still get a lot of oil. He knows how to cut a deal. But this killing, this has to stop. And that's why the Jews in Israel, they are mad at Netanyahu. They see what's going on. They know what's happening. But you can't come out and say it. You can't say America is running this show, which is exactly what we're doing. And just to laugh for a couple seconds here, Zelensky unveiled his victory plan to his own parliament. I will play the report first about the victory plan. This morning.